Welcome to the second season of the Doc Industry Podcast. Like in 2020, the podcast was realized in collaboration with the What's Up with Docs podcast and the programmers of Color Collective. Join us for discussions on topics such as the limited representation of brown LGBTQ plus stories in the cinematic space, the lack of inclusivity in the mainstream press, and the possibilities of Caribbean avant-garde cinema. The Doc Industry podcasts are funded by Creative Europe, the City of Leipzig, MDM, and BKM. Thank you to our partners and collaborators for their contribution. Enjoy!
Looking from the South. In 2015, a hashtag forever changed the face of the Oscar Academy in the United States, Oscar So White. Because that year, major nominations were entirely white, a claim for more diversity and inclusion led to the massive entry of new members, including international ones. In line with this, we are delighted to introduce you to three Academy members who share a common love and dedication for documentary and Africa. The Egyptian filmmaker and producer Jihan El-Tari, who is also the director of DocsBox, an institution based in Berlin that supports documentary filmmakers from Africa and the Arab world since 2014. Hello.
Hello.
The Cameroonian filmmaker and producer Jean-Marie Teno, who launched a training session entitled Patrimoine Heritage, which took place in Banjun Station in 2017, in Bangulap in 2018, and currently in Yaoundé, Cameroon. Hello, Jean-Marie.
Hello, Claire. Nice to be part of this panel.
And the Nigerian filmmaker and producer Femi Odugbemi, who is also the executive director of the I Represent International Documentary Film Festival that he co-founded in Lagos, Nigeria, back in 2010. Hi, Femi.
Hi, good to see you guys. Nice to be here.
My name is Claire Diao, and I will be moderating this discussion on behalf of the Doc Leipzig industry team and the Programmers of Colors Collective proposal. So hi, everyone, and thank you for taking part of this discussion.
Thank you for organizing it.
First of all, could you please tell us how you have learned that you would become an Oscar Academy member? Jihan?
I think it was in late 2016. So that was just the year after the event. I got an email that said in my inbox saying invitation to become member of the Academy. And it had this orange big button saying press. And I thought it was spam. So I binned it, basically. And 2 weeks later, I got a phone call saying, do you accept or not? You're the only one who hasn't confirmed. And I was like, what are you talking about? And I said, oh, that wasn't spam. Can you send it again, please? So it was actually a very big surprise. And I think at the time there were very, very few. And I think it came to all of us as a bit of a surprise.
Oh, Jean-Marie, yes. That year I also received, it was 2016, end of the year. And I received a call of some people in the US who said that they were thinking of inviting me to be a member of the Academy. And they wanted to know if I had anything against it or if I would accept. So I said, well, what are we going to be doing? So I had followed the discussions about representation in the Oscar, and they said, yes, you know, it's important to be part of the group to make sure that we are represented as well. And I think that was the same year when Jihan, because that was the year when I thought you were the three who were selected that year on the continent. So
and they were opening.
Yes, that was in the documentary section. So Yes, that's how it happened. And I was really surprised because I was not, I didn't know that my work was supposed to be part of this Oscar thing, and Hollywood for me, it was something so remote for my of my concern. So it was interesting. And the part that I loved it about it was the possibility of watching as many films as possible. And that's what I've been doing almost every year, since, to be able to watch films from all over the world without, you know, moving from my space.
Thank you. Femi?
Well, a couple of generations later, I guess. It was in 2018, and I was on the set of one of the TV series I was making at the time, and I got the phone call, and of course I shut down the call because I thought it was some kind of gimmick, and I really didn't believe it. So I did call Jaman to say, look, this is what I got, and he said, just chill, you'll get another call, which is really what happened. For me, I think I more or less embraced it on behalf of many people on this side, on behalf of the work that we've been trying to do for a few years. And it just sort of indicated a sense of to be seen, that, you know, the sort of documentary culture that we're trying to kind of build from the ground up, certainly been helped by, you know, people like Jehan and Jean-Marie, who have made their way here to make it possible. So I do think, you know, on behalf of Jaman and Theo and Mackie and all these guys who have been incredibly selfless trying to do this, it was really nice that our work, you know, was noticed. And that's the sense in which I you know, received it.
I'll have to say that the fact that it was, you know, the whole story I said about it being, thinking it was spam and not really having much time to decide. Obviously, I said yes, because, you know, one gets a bit taken by, oh my God, what is this? But after the fact, I have to say that it became a bit wondering whether, why all of a sudden, especially coming after the 2015, and we had conversations about this amongst us, and it was we were really wondering whether, is this a real move towards diversity, or is it because of what has happened, then they just need names to put there saying, see, we're not just white. And there was a moment of hesitation there as to what does one do. It was more really about, this is, in any case, such a platform needs our voice. And once we're on such a platform, how do you get in and open up more space? So I think we moved from the idea of, are we being tokenized, to the idea, it doesn't really matter if we're being tokenized or not, as long as we can open more space.
So what do you think about the Academy documentary selection process? Is it a lonely task, or do you have group meetings on a regular basis? Who wants to answer first?
No, Jean-Marie? Yes, I can go, yes. There are not really meetings, because you have so many films that appear on the platform, and you have deadlines to cast votes. And I make sure that every year I can vote, actually. So I watch the films and I try to know as much as possible about the films. And I encourage people from the continent who have films in the program, to, if they have to do some lobbying, I invite other members to watch the films and to support the films. So it's really about making these films become visible and be seen long enough in the academy room and have people talk more about the film so that there is some visibility about the cinema that are not just a certain section of the academy or certain section of the industry want to promote. And now, and at the end, sometimes you are very frustrated because after all the work, you finally see the films that get even the votes and you say, oh my God, how can this film, the film that get to be in the shortlist, and say maybe if there were more and more people from the continent and also from various parts of the world who are member of the academy, maybe there could be some shift into the kind of films that get nominated and that get attention.
Jihan, is there a feeling of uselessness of watching so many films and not being able to decide which are the final?
I mean, sometimes I say I'm going to be killed by film at some point because I think I'm on a schedule of at least two films a day, come hell or high water. But I, exactly as what Jean-Marie was saying, the process is, you know, you just, it's a very, we're sent the films, now they're on the platform. When one first started, I used to get DVDs and that sort of thing. But there's something I really would like to say about this, because there remains to be a two-tier system. Because if you're living in Paris, London, or New York, you can actually get to see the films in the cinema with the Academy members. And I did this once or twice in Paris when I was there. And it's a completely different experience. Obviously, it's only London, Paris, LA, and New York. But also, adding to what Jean-Marie was saying, you watch all these films, you put your shortlist, you go through the process, and suddenly the films that are winning, you're thinking, where did that come from? Who's actually voting for this? I mean, I have been very dramatically surprised about some of the collections. And I think the most frustrating thing is that there's no way to actually find out how this process is going, or to even have debates amongst us as Academy members once there is a shortlist. So I'm not entirely clear, I'll be honest, although I've been there for a few years, I'm not entirely clear how that actually, ultimately, the last selection, how that happens. Is it just a counting of the clicks, the lobbying? I mean, we all know that, and especially as Academy members, we are bombarded, like bombarded being the understatement of the year, of promotion of certain films, okay? And the amount of money and the amount of communication that goes towards certain films, I think gives it quite an imbalance. Because suddenly there are certain films that you recognize their names, and it really gives them an advantage. And so it's the communication around certain films rather than the quality or the interest of the film that somehow, I think, imbalances the system. But that's only my opinion.
Femi, regarding what Jihan just said, what do you think of the average amount of African entries? Do you watch, do you receive a lot of African documentaries? And do they have the same marketing power of the ones who bombard your email addresses?
Well, I suppose in the last 3 years that I've been part of the process, I think the most significant observation I've had is what Jihan just said, the power of promotion. The power of big marketing budgets, the power of the big studios. So for me, the politics of winning is something that is still needs to be addressed. Clearly, African cinema is at a huge disadvantage. And when I say African cinema, I don't just mean the you know, I mean, cinema stories from Africa, about Africa, they're still somewhat of a disadvantage, at a disadvantage when you see how these elections play out. Even if it's a voting electronically, the numbers simply is such that with the massive promotion and publicity that the big studios and the big films are able to do, I mean, channels like Discovery and all these guys who have, you know, the budget to really push the film and to push their influence on members of the Academy who vote. I think all of that still kind of puts, lays the weight to one side, to the advantage of a certain kind of stories. I do also look at it from this perspective. I mean, I used to get DVDs early on, and now it's all, you know, you go into your into the platform. It's wonderful also to beyond watch films, to also get involved with things like the mentoring opportunities, the storytelling labs that you can actually help younger filmmakers with. So for me, I think it's important that we also prioritize the opportunity to network within ourselves as African, you know, storytellers, so that the networking is not just limited to our numbers. It needs to be widened, not just our numbers, but our influence. And I think the way to go about that is to actually begin to be involved in the many other initiatives of the Academy. But just like Jean-Marie, you know, and Jehan have said, there is a sort of sanitized thing to the process where you're not, you know, Jehan is only able to attend those screenings together. I get invitations to all those screenings, but they're in New York, they're in London, they're everywhere. I can't immediately get up and
they
go.
They don't offer plane tickets.
No, of course not. And it's also reasonable to understand that if the big studios and those who push the publicity and promotion sort of do the numbers, putting screenings on my side of the pool may not really be particularly useful. But there is a certain coldness to the calculations that is beyond the artistic considerations of the films. Granted that, you know, the ones that do get nominated, I mean, I've sort of tried to check, yeah, in the nomination process, yeah, you do sort of kind of see that maybe there were things that you voted for that, you know, kind of look like it ended up on that list. But like has just been said, the final winning one is always kind of weird, you know, because you hear it just as everybody hears it. So I assume it's the tabulation of the numbers, but clearly the power of a big studio is alive and it's well, and influence is a key success factor in the films that go on to do very well.
So what would you recommend to small company that are eligible with a film, with a documentary film?
For me, I think we've got to make you've got to lean forward and at least do the game of numbers. Those members of the Academy that are within the continent that you can reach, and those ones that can reach others, if they're convinced about the film, I think to just begin to actually not just sell it within the network of the Academy itself, but to make the right kind of noises about it within the territories in which we are. I have made a point every year to sort of talk about the Academy selections at IREP, just so that people go and read about it and get interested about it. And hopefully, you know, we create some kind of, new cycle that allows people to know that we're kind of interested in this, because I think that's also part of it, that until until you know, filmmakers from Africa and of African descent were being selected for the Academy, you had that feeling that, you know, the continent was really not on the radar in terms of, did people even care if you saw the films or if you were, you know, inclined to be interested in the process at all. Yes. And I think that's very important that...
Jihan?
Yes, I just wanted to go backwards a bit in terms of the actual eligibility process itself is problematic. Please. It's problematic because it makes the whole system pretty much a North American affair. Because if you haven't come out in North America and the rest of it. And so that in many ways, I mean, I'm not going to go through the whole list of eligibility, but I think we have to deal with this whole academy for what it is. It is a North American affair. And I think and we cannot also forget that it's not a festival. It's simply an awards ceremony. And so I think that the clout and the visibility that has become attached to the name gives it a recognition way beyond its actual filmmaking value, if you want. Maybe I'm not being politically correct, but I think we have to call things by their name. And I'm not entirely sure to what extent us as Africans need to spend the amount of money necessary for the lobbying and for the doing everything necessary just to rub shoulders with those who are going to be there anyway. So the mere fact that we're present, that in at least since I've been around, there has been at least one or two good films that have reached the final shortlist. So be it. Should we be encouraging people to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to get that label? Oscar winning? I would say no.
But I also open the floor to the distinction nowadays between documentary and fiction. Do you think it's the genre is more recognized by the industry nowadays?
Well, before answering that question, I would just say that, of course, there are companies who spend a lot of money, who make a lot of publicity. During the first years, I was curious to watch this film that had so much publicity and so much noise around, and most of the time I was really so disappointed. So at the end, I finally realized that it's not the quality of the film that make all the noise that they make on internet and everything. Because I was curious to see what are all these films about. Read the, and I was watching, and sometimes you have great surprises. You have very low budget films sometimes from Macedonia or from another place who suddenly appear in the shortlist, and you watch and it's such a wonderful film, and without having all this publicity or everything, it stayed there. And you have sometimes some French or some that also are there. So let's just take the Academy for what it is, a place where you can just watch as many movies as possible, and you have the opportunity to just say, okay, these ones, we can push some of them forward so that they can advance. And when they are part of a shortlist, even the 12 or 25 shortlist, maybe they get noticed in various parts in the world and have maybe the career of these films. But to win, to be at the position of winning 1 year, well, I don't know. If that happens, great. I've seen some very brilliant American films, African-American films, and who went as far as the short list, but never made it. And just they're saying, what? How are we even going from the continent be able to change anything in this whole system? So I'm just saying, well, if it opens the floor for people to have the film better known and all over the world, that's already a step. And regarding the fact that us member of the documentary section of the Academy can vote also for the foreign films and for almost every section now, that's really great, because watching all these films from all over the world, you can see how the narrative, how filmmaking, how the challenges of narrative all over the world are evolving. And really, when we are talking to younger generation, really to say, don't be shy, just try and try whatever you want to try, because all over the world, people are creating and bringing some new voices and everything. So for me, that's the only important thing that the Academy really brought to me, to just make people to not have any inferiority complex with the stories and the storytelling method.
So is the documentary genre more included now?
I mean, I think documentary has existed for a while. But I mean, if again, you'll allow me just to add on to what Jean-Marie was saying. I think amongst the things that makes me wonder that you get quite a harmonious kind of formatted content. It's extremely rare to find a different kind of a voice that gets to that selection. And every now and then one gets really excited because you specifically talked about Macedonia. And Macedonia, the film was called Honeyland, yeah. Which was amazing. You thought, oh, amazing. But then I did actually meet the people who made it. Once they got into, the film started with nothing. The people started with nothing, and it was absolutely amazing. But once they got into that machine, a lot of the money that they had to be spent was because of that machine. Now, that's one of the rare examples of a different kind of a voice. But I would say 90, because I actually do watch most of the films, 99% are the kind of typical structure format where it's safe. There's very little experimental. I would even say experimental is almost frowned upon. And you wonder, like, in such a space, and again, I'll give a very good, in my opinion, good example, and that is in last year's international fiction, there was this Hong Kong film that was absolutely mind-blowing in terms of a different voice, a space that was never seen, a real issue and the rest of it. And practically everyone I spoke to who is a member of the Academy and even beyond the Africa members of the Academy, there was no comparison. And then, of course, it didn't win. And what did win? The absolutely typical formatted, we know what the beginning and the middle and the end, and absolutely no surprise, but it is more appealing to the masses. And so I underline what Jean-Marie said, that we have to take the Academy for what it is. It is a more audience-based, commercial space for films to shine. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with this, but it is not a space where new voices and different voices will be encouraged to rock the boat, I would say.
Thank you. That allowed me to switch on and continue on what you're all doing separately, but in the same way. Femi Adubemi, you are wearing various hats, including screenwriter, cinematographer, and photographer. But regarding your position of executive director of IREP, after 11 years of film festival, what are your best achievements in bringing more attention to documentary within the Nigerian film industry and Nollywood?
Well, you have to understand that we started IREP as a response to the absolute lack of any kind of understanding of what documentary really is and can be within the Nollywood environment. Here we are in Nigeria, where there's all this noise about a very, you know, burgeoning film industry, and there was really nothing about documentary there, simply because, you know, documentary was always, in the sense that Nigerians knew it, simply propaganda stuff that government did. So for us, it was very important to sort of get with the task of building it from the ground up. Trying to build an audience is really what I think has been one of our bigger objectives that I think we've made great progress with. We've been able to attract to documentary a new, you know, and young population of both creators and audiences. We've tried to make it less elitist, so that everyone that wanted to watch could watch, perhaps not always in a big cinema, since we don't have a lot of that, but we've had big night screenings at the park where everyone could come. We've brought filmmakers who are, you know, real artists in documentary, so that they could show some of their past work, speak and engage with the student, with the young people. We've tried to just take documentary as something that was a tool for these young people to tell their stories, to sort of, like, you know, document their experiences, but do it artistically. And the idea that, you know, we could provide for them training along the way to do that. The results of that over the 11 years has been that, you know, in our first festival in 2010, we had roughly 70 people in all. You know, Jihan was one of those. And at the last festival, the one before the virtual, we had over 4,000 people over the course of 3 days. And these are not wow. People passing by. These are people who actually intended to come and to watch different things. And we were able to now have multiple venues, now have the Nigerian Film Corporation Cinema in Ikoyi be part of it, now have Gothe be part of it, British Council. So it's become this thing that, you know, within Lagos, it's part of the calendar. People can decide where they want to watch what. And I thought we had a momentum going until COVID came, and we're gonna try and recover that. We've formed partnerships with, you know, the DocFest in Germany, the German films. We've formed partnership with Africa World Documentary Film Festival, just to sort of widen our selection process and try to also show films that young filmmakers are making to young filmmakers, so they kind of see that it's, you know, very it's a very good platform to express artistically. Because what we need to achieve is so much more. We really can't stop. I think we're headed in the right direction. I think we're beginning to build the kind of audiences, not just in Lagos, but across the country, because now we do monthly screenings at different universities. And I think all of this together ultimately, you know, creates the sort of environment that we hope reignites documentary culture in Nigeria, and hopefully in the countries near us as well.
Thank you. Jean-Marie Teno, you're involved in many workshops and organizations such as DOCA, based in Kenya. But regarding your program, Patrimoine Heritage, what is the impact on your local trainees?
Well, Patrimoine Heritage is a young movement. I started that after being invited in 2015 by a collective of young filmmakers who wanted me to come and mentor them into writing documentaries. And I was really shocked when many of them came to me and said, we don't really know what subject we need to work on to attract the attention of big festivals like the Berlinale or like Cannes and everything. So I was really shocked and upset. I looked around me. There are so many things people can talk about, but most of these young people were trying to talk about their own environment through the lens of what the big festivals or what people from outside want to see about Africa. And I was so upset about that, that I said to myself, I'm going to come again, but I'm going to train people, not just at random like that. I'm going to force them to look around them. And I thought that talking about the heritage, we're going to be training people to make documentaries specifically on material or immaterial heritage, so that at least they are forced to look around them. Because one of the consequences of the whole colonial brainwashing is to turn many of us around here as people who live in their own country as if they were just tourists, as if they were not even seeing what was going on. And really to challenge that is really to bring people to start looking at their environment and really grab it and really talk about it, make film about it, whether people, the authorities are happy about it or not. And so that's how we started in 2017 with the first edition. And everybody, wherever I went, people say, oh, Jean-Marie Thénault, oh, that's trouble. We're not going to allow this guy to make his training because he's going to become political and blah, blah. So I said, I'm talking about the heritage. So what is political about that? I don't want to deal with politics. And I reassure people as much as I could, of course. I know that heritage is very political. And gradually now they are understanding that whatever you do, anything that you touch and you touch your history, your memory, all that is political. And now for this year, we had 45 people who applied, and the level of the students who are applying are really so high. Most of them have a master's, and really we are dealing with very, very interesting topics. And they are young, most of them are around their 30s or below 30s. And of course it's becoming a problem because people who are in their 40s, 45 are saying, well, we also won't have things to say. Why don't you open the training to older generation because we have lived and we've seen so much. We want to talk, to express. So it's becoming really something popular, but I'm just at the beginning. And of course, we need support to be able to start something strong in Central African region, because of course, cinema is almost as if with all the political problems that we have in this region, cinema have deserted us, and many people who are organizing either the festivals or even the labs that are being organized doesn't seem to be people who are really speaking from within the communities. They are just seem to be people who are just being the, how do you say, the box, the address box of people from outside who have their own agenda and who are just putting in place their own agenda to continue the same old system. And I'm trying with Patrimoine Heritage to challenge that and to challenge that in a modest way, because the first two editions, I was the only one training. We made 11 short films. For this time, the Goethe and the French Institute supported the workshop. And I have a French guy from the Atelier Varan who came for the writing process and for the editing. Someone from a professional from Germany is coming also. But next year, I'm going to ask them to give the money, but I'm going to select African professionals to come and so that we can continue the work. That's the struggle, my fight, the fight I'm trying to pull for documentary and make documentary from an African and from African perspective.
That's really important. So thank you for fighting for this. Jihan El Tahri, you were also involved in many organizations and as a mentor, like the Waga Film Lab in Burkina Faso. But let's talk about Docs Box. How do you support emerging filmmakers from Africa and the Arab world?
Okay. I think let's start with documentary. And I think there's been a considerable shift in what documentary is, represents, how it's done, how it's assessed over the past 10, 15 years, a very considerable one. And can't forget that Michael Moore with the documentary did win the Palme d'Or in Cannes. And I think that that was a turning point, whether we like Michael Moore or not, that's not the issue. And ever since there have been in the official selections documentary, there has been a kind of adjustment and actually, just yesterday, the UNESCO published a report about the state of the industry on the African continent. And what I found very interesting in the report, that they started, it was like, how do we define film industry? And based on the shifts in the digital and the rest of it, within the same category, fiction, feature, of any kind and documentary are put on the same level. So I do think it's important to recognize that documentary is no longer the ugly duckling of the industry. It was always for a long time, I mean, like when all of us started, let's not count how many years ago, people kind of presumed that you do documentary as a springboard to one day be able to make fiction, rather than recognize documentary as a language in and of itself. So I do think it's important to underline that we've overcome this obstacle. When people who do documentary as a choice of form. And I think that's amazing. So from there, we again need to say that the digital world has changed the nature, digital world in terms of production, as well as in terms of broadcasting, has changed the nature of documentaries fabrication, as well as its access. So given all these different elements, I think one of the biggest problems today isn't the nature of documentary or the space or the audience. In my personal opinion, which what will then bring me to Doc's Box, is that the biggest problem is the narrative. And in a way, what Jean-Marie was saying, are we going to comply to ticking the boxes in terms of form and narrative of what works for the outside? Or now that we have the space and the visibility, are we going to finally tell our own stories the way we want to tell them, in whichever format we want to tell them? And it's, I think we do have the space, and it is based on that within Doc's Box, we have 7 programs. Two of them are really based on how do we break the format and tell the story from a Southern vantage point. So for example, Women in Docs, which is a 9-month bursary for 6 women from 6 African countries, African Arab countries, working together. We actually just mixed and graded 2 of the films this morning. We spent the first 4 months of that program basically turning the way we work on its head, rather than start of what is the synopsis, what is this and what is that and what is the treatment. Turn it around. What is your story? Which vantage point are you telling it from? And absolutely every single person who participated in the 9 months were people from the South. Breaking the format also means that a story is a story. You don't have to just be dealing with documentary filmmakers to tell a story. We can all learn from each other. How do you best reflect around how to tell a story? So we've had people from Jean-Pierre Beccolo to Raed Andoni to everyone, but it was a very clear decision that as much as we love amazing filmmakers from the North, right now, this is not the moment to be seeking that kind of help, because the help we need on the continent, at least in DocsBox's point of view now, is how do you shift the narrative? How do you provide the tools of the voice? And so that is contained in how you choose the idea, how you choose how to tell the idea, how do you research the idea? And so the breakdown of the curriculum took us about a year to how do you invert that? So, and then the other program we're in the midst of launching right now is an archive-based program, and it's called People's Stories, and it's only archive-based films. And again, it's 1 year in Senegal and 1 year in Morocco. And it's also how do you provide the infrastructure to translate, interrogate, reassess what this archive footage is telling us about ourselves. Are we going to be reassessing it again from the same prism, or can we take a step back and say, at this point, we have the digital means, we have the know-how, we have amazing people who you can call experts, and people hire us all over the world. It's time now to look at what is it that we are bringing to the table. It's not just a catch-up game. It's like, what is it do we have to say, and where and how do we place we have to say within the grid of this global narrative? And I believe that we have a space there that needs to be taken and is being taken, actually. There are more documentary filmmakers over the past 10 years by choice than anything else. And just my last comment would be the actual opening statement of that UNESCO report. It says that the production and distribution of film and audiovisual work is one of the most dynamic growth sectors in the world. If you look at the numbers and the breakdowns, I mean, honestly, you were just saying, Femi, that Nigeria is saying this and that. If you look at the numbers, it is totally impressive. And ironically, it's not Southern Africa and Northern Africa that we always regard as the most advanced, but rather it's West Africa and East Africa. So I think we're on track.
And that's good. And that's why we also make this podcast. Do you have a comment, Femi, on especially this topic, looking from the South, what the Southern filmmakers, producers, film industry can bring to the global cinematic landscape?
Well, a worldview. And I think that's really what's critical out of what I think Jan is saying, which is really the foundations of IREP itself. In IREP, we talk about Africa in self-conversation, about deciding what is our story, how do we wish to tell it, and then to access the platforms that technology offers to tell it to the world, not as a means of seeking validation, but as a claim to our rights to actually a different kind of world. And I think it's our stories that's going to do that. So it's no surprise that, you know, the creative industries are growing at such amazing, you know, in such amazing numbers. The access is there. The training can be better. But for me, what I think is also critical for us is reclaiming our archives. I think that's really going to be the key to us being able to tell our stories in such a way that we can track back and retell some of the stories that are being told about who we are and how we see the world. Of course, that's really, for me, maybe the next thing is that as we are training filmmakers and storytellers, as we're trying to interrogate the process and and approaches to storytelling, we've got to understand that as much as they took the artifacts, they also took away the stories simply by crafting it from a certain perspective that we need to correct in order for us to be able to in fact recover ourselves, recover, you know, even amongst ourselves, how we tell the history, you know, of our country, who were the heroes, who are actually, you know, the villains, and how we got to where we got to. Those archives are not here. They're not, and access to them is also something that I think is a critical war to fight, that I hope that, you know, as we all acquire more and more influence, we're able to put that as well out there as something that is critical to the growth of the kind of documentary cinema that would in fact work for Africa.
And to fill in the gaps of silent spaces.
Yes. Of course, I'm really amazed even by the decolonial movement and all these. Well, when I look back at what I've been doing for the last 35 years, when I did Affliction de Plumeray in 92, and all my work, of course, all my life has been to speak from where I've lived, I was from. And I did that all my life. And we wrote a book to go through the process that I went through, because I was misunderstood for such a long time, because people would say, what is he doing? And so Real Resistance is almost the story of my life accompanying the film that I've made for the rest of, for almost all my life. And now transmitting and going, meeting young filmmakers, showing them the film that I've made, other people who also have questioned the form, who have really made statements from where they were without asking or asking recognition. And by doing that, we are just showing them that critical thinking is one of the key things that we have lost in the whole colonial process, and to decolonize their own way of thinking. And it's also very fascinating when suddenly I invite a white person to come to my training, and the first reaction for the first week is almost like, everybody seems to forget that I'm the boss. I'm the one who started the whole program. And they just think that everything coming from a white person is God's word. So we deconstruct even all that to show that there have been so many people who came from the north, who came on the continent. Sometimes they were incompetent and they were celebrated, not because of what they were saying, just because of the image or the imaginary that was created around them. And so critical thinking, bringing people to really go back and question and question and challenge and find new ways of telling stories and learning about even the structure that are in the dances, the music, our music, and meeting people, suddenly people who are in theater, who are working on what the Bikutsi means, what is the structure of the Bikutsi, what the whole culture, how, what are in this culture. And to have someone who has been to Germany to study Brecht and who comes back and says, I've started studying the Bikutsi and I realized that I didn't have to go all the way to understand all this about human nature, because if you start questioning how women are dancing in the village, what they are saying, the structure of their storytelling, I mean, you learn so much from when you start understanding the continent in which we live, that is so rich in terms of narratives, in terms of humor, in terms of so many things. For me, being here and accompanying people to make their films about heritage, it's almost like I'm being born again and rediscovering even my own culture and my own country, and hoping to tell stories to allow more people to rediscover and to find out and to be proud of where we are from. I've always been proud of who I was, and I've been always a strong head, but now I'm even finding more gratification allowing people to bring out all these stories. And And I don't care if he doesn't go to any festival or anywhere. And people will say, oh, he's saying that he's a member of the academy. I just say, well, it allows me to watch films, you know. But if you want to become a member of the academy, you make films. Maybe you might be there one day, but first make films that really matter, that are going to be around for a long time, because people will learn from your film, people would enjoy your films. And that's what I'm trying to bring to the younger generation as my duty, and also as a game, because cinema at the beginning was a game, and a game that I enjoyed doing because it was fun. And I want to continue making documentaries and having fun, challenging, questioning, learning, and transmitting.
That's yes.
My motto.
Jihan, final word. With this title, Looking from the South, do you see more and more opening in the worldwide cinematographic landscape to the voices coming from the South?
Yes, and I think it is growing. I just think that what are these voices seeking? Are they seeking prizes in A festivals? Unfortunately, if that is the case, there's ever only space for one or two faces there. But if they're seeking, as to what Jean-Marie and Femi and myself have been saying, you know, it's time for us to talk with our own voice, with our own aesthetic, with our own desires, structures. I mean, who said we ever have to and always have to tell linear stories? The way we tell stories doesn't have to be linear. You know, we can experiment alternatively. And I think my last word actually would be, watch out for the digital. We think that the digital is a place of inclusion. It can be, but it can also be a space of exclusion. We're all very delighted about Netflix and Zoom and all these things that is making it more of a global village, but they can be a space of exclusion, because the danger for me of the digital is that it's spreading what the visual criteria and what the narratives should look like beyond borders. And right now the control remains in the hands and the power in the hands of platforms like Netflix, who are about selling stories rather than about making the world look at each other at eye level. And I think this right now, the digital still has spaces for all these voices to appear and be very interesting and join the orchestra of sounds that we can all enjoy. But this space is closing. The digital space is being taken over, and the African continent, only a bit of it that is chosen will be part of that, and the others will be excluded, which is what happens in Zoom. What happens in Zoom, if you don't have the money to be on a Zoom, you're not on a panel anymore, and you can be muted whenever somebody feels like it.
Mm. And have electricity cut and internet cuts.
Absolutely. Well. And so what happens is that, oh, it's going to upset the balance, take them out. It's fine. It's a technical problem. And the content of the narrative, look at something like The Octopus Teacher. And it's a wonderful visual regalia. But which African? Is that African cinema? Is that what Africans are moving towards? But that is what is being celebrated. So I think we should be careful. We should keep our eyes open. There's space there. There's amazing things happening. And just be careful. Keep your eyes open. That's what I have to say.
And that's a good end word for the end. Keep your eyes open. This was Looking from the South with Femi Odugbemi, Jean-Marie Thénault, Jihan El-Tahri, a podcast moderated by Claire Diao and recorded by Anne Redfeld for the Doc Leipzig Industry 2021, with a special thanks to Programmers of Colors Collective. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.